for law enforcement to be able to redirect precious and limited law enforcement resources into violent crimes and not be running down, petty and nonviolent pot-smoking offenses. And because I come from a European perspective, I've spent a third of my adult life living out of a carry-on airplane-sized suitcase in Europe, talking to people who also have challenges in their societies with drug abuse. And they remind me that a society has to make a choice, tolerate alternative lifestyles or build more prisons. And they always remind me with an annoying little kicker that Americans lock up 10 times as many people per capita as Europeans do. Either we're inherently more criminal or there's something messed up about our laws. And I don't think we're inherently more criminal. I think we've just got ourselves some very misguided laws here. And just like courageous citizens and leaders worked our country out of the expensive and cost and non-productive prohibition against alcohol back in the 1930s, today leaders are helping us work our way out of the prohibition of our age, which is the criminalization of marijuana.
Right. That's a good perspective to have on it. So you are doing a 10-city tour in the state of Oregon that is called Travel as a Political Act, Ending Marijuana Prohibition in Oregon, mm-hmm. taking your travel expertise and applying it to this incredibly brave political act. From what I understand, the city of Portland seems to have a lot of support for ballot measure 91. How do you intend to gain support from communities outside of Portland? Because you are going to other small towns. I mean, you're going to Salem, you're also going to Medford and a number of other places.
Well, you know, it's, the main challenge for us is just to get people up to speed on just the context here and the practical reasons that Measure 91 is smart law. You can frame this in a conservative way. You can frame this in a progressive way. For me, it's just common sense. I think that Oregon, you know, arrests or cites 13,000 people a year for marijuana. These aren't rich white guys. These are poor people and people of color. This costs the society millions of dollars just immediately in legal expenses and so on. But much more important, it messes up 13,000 people's lives. And these are people who cannot afford this kind of a bump in the road. And then they have a record and they can't get a job or they can't get into school. And that brings real cost to our society later on. I know that law enforcement is a precious and limited resource here, and we're wasting too many law enforcement resources on petty marijuana crimes. I do want to remind Oregonians, when they hear somebody coming from out of state telling them that they should continue locking up pot smokers, you got to ask yourself, what motivates this person? And who paid for his plane ticket into this state? And I would bet that, I know as a matter of fact, that pharmaceutical companies and organizations that profit from the fact that marijuana is illegal are paying for these people to come into the state and promote the status quo. I'm taking a week off of my work up in Seattle, and I'm coming down here on my own penny because I know that Oregonians are smart and caring citizens, and they just need to get somebody to explain to them that it is a wrong-minded prohibition. And I think one thing that a lot of people misunderstand is they just assume use is going to go up when we legalize, tax, and regulate. And our experience is, and every society's experience is, there's no correlation between consumption and how strict the laws are. I firmly believe, and I'll stick by this, that after Oregon legalizes, taxes, and regulates marijuana, use will not go up substantially. It may spike up in the beginning because it'll be kind of curious. Then it'll settle down. My firm belief is that people who want to smoke pot already do. And we can just take the crime out of the equation and treat it as a health challenge and an education challenge when it comes to the abuse of marijuana and a civil liberty for the mature adult use. And I feel this way, because every society that has lightened up on its laws has found that use does not go up. And today, by every country's measure, Americans smoke more per capita than Europeans do, in spite of the fact that you can do hard time for smoking pot in the United States and a joint's about as exciting as a can of beer in most of Europe. And the Dutch, who are famous for their liberal laws on marijuana, smoke less than the European average,
really?
Leading us to continue to believe that use will not go up when marijuana is legalized.
And in the state of Washington, you were instrumental in getting their similar laws passed. Well, first I was going to ask, you know, have you seen that change there with the use of marijuana smoking? Right. And yeah, secondly, what do you intend to do here in Oregon?
Yeah, I worked very hard in Washington State, and 2 years ago it was a little dicier than it is now because we were groundbreaking on that. And, you know, I was just in our mayor, Jay Inslee, who's our governor, is a friend of mine, and I was just at his mansion there in Olympia, and we were just enjoying an afternoon and talking. And I'll tell you, he was not involved in this whole marijuana thing, but suddenly he's the governor, and we're the first state along with Colorado to legalize, and it's in his lap. 2 years later, he is so thankful that we are arresting 5,000 people less this year. 5,000 people who would have been arrested in our state did not get arrested in our state because we passed IPLFO2 2 years ago. We have taken the money out of organized crime. Marijuana was a cash crop rivaling apples in Washington State. And today we are well on the way to making this not a black market industry, but a regulated industry that employs people, that is taxed. And now, instead of enriching and empowering gangs and organized crime, we've got businesses that are paying lots of taxes. And every year our state is going to be getting hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue. Oregon's Measure 91 is a little lighter on the taxation because they want to make sure that marijuana is not more expensive legally than it is on the black market, so we can snuff out the black market. But even with that, Oregon's going to be generating tens of millions of dollars a year, and this will be earmarked for drug education, drug treatment, health programs, and law enforcement issues. We'll be able to study marijuana better and better control safety issues on the road, and on. There's just so many reasons to say yes for Measure 91 here in Oregon.
Definitely. As we come to the close of our interview, are there any other points that, or a specific issue that you want our listeners to take away and our voters to take away from this conversation that we haven't discussed?
Well, first of all, I'd remind you that there's a lot of people that make money because marijuana is illegal. I call them the PPP, the Pot Prohibition Profiteers. They can be to the left, people who think marijuana should not be regulated, and they can be to the right. People who think we should lock up pot smokers, but all of them, I find, or not all of them, but just a lot of them are motivated not by what they think is right, but what they think is going to be good for their bottom line. And I think people in Oregon need to look at the issue carefully. Remember, use will not go up, but we'll take the crime out of the equation. We'll take the racism out of the issue. We will free up law enforcement to refocus their limited and precious resources to serious crime. And we will do great things, I think, to keep marijuana away from people under 21 and to protect safety on the road. And, it is an off-year election. So for me, I think Oregonians generally understand the wisdom of Measure 91, but it is an off-year election, which makes these kind of initiatives a little more of a challenge. So if people understand the importance of this, I think they should talk it up. They can go to the Yes on Measure 91 website, and they can learn more about the issue, and they can get out their friends to vote.
Great. Thank you so much, Rick Steves, for taking time to chat with me and for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
All right. Thank you for what you're doing, and best wishes.
Next, I spoke with Jose Antonio Vargas, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and undocumented immigrant. He spent a full day speaking at various community organizing events around Portland and Salem, campaigning for Measure 88, which, if passed, would provide an alternate driver's license for undocumented immigrants. What, we're talking about Measure 88 today. That's, I think, the story of your entire 24 hours here in Oregon. Tell us why you came all the way to Oregon to campaign so hard for this.
Well, first of all, I have to say that I'm eternally grateful for the state of Oregon, because if it wasn't for Oregon in 2003, I would not have been able to get a driver's license, which was the only piece of government-issued ID I had for 8 years. So without that license, I would not have had a job at the Washington Post, at Rolling Stone, at the New Yorker, as a reporter, because I had to travel and, drive. Is there anything more American than driving? And then one of your governor took that away in 2008. But thankfully, bipartisan support, governor signed this law. But unfortunately, a relatively small but effective group of Oregonians was able to force it into a ballot measure. And that's why we're here today.
Well, go back for one second. You said that you were able to get a license in 2003. What was the law or the regulation that allowed it then that changed in 2008?
So in 2008, they just tightened the requirements to get a driver's license. So in 2003, this was the only state that I could think of where I could have gone and get a license.
Because you didn't live here, but you didn't.
But actually, thankfully, I had a friend who was like, hey, use my address. but now, actually, there are 10 other states, California, Washington State, Nevada, Maryland, New Mexico, that allow undocumented people to get driver's licenses. So Oregon would be joining those states.
And speaking of those states, do you have any statistics off the top of your head how this has benefited people, how this has benefited taxpayers?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, first and foremost, this is a public safety issue. I think we would all want somebody driving to know how to drive and to be insured. So I just mentioned California is about to get a driver's license to undocumented people like me, and I cannot wait. And for the first time in my life, I'm actually thinking of buying a car. Can you imagine how many new car owners and how much money that would add to the economy of Oregon if you allowed undocumented people here to actually drive legally,
right,
and with some sort of protection? I don't know. I mean, you all know we're here.
Right.
You know we're driving. How do you think we get around? You know, and this is not for us. This is not about rewarding, quote unquote, criminality. This is about doing what's actually safe and what's actually common sense. And we know nothing is going to happen in Washington, D.C. when it comes to immigration reform. So that's why states, you know, have to actually try to figure out what they can do to alleviate the pain and the struggle that their undocumented residents live through every day.
So how does one apply for this? If it passes, once it passes, how does one,
so
how does the process
you
work?
Actually have to live and have an address in Oregon to prove that you actually have residence here. You have to be able to actually pass the written tests and the actual tests. And you have to be able to actually put yourself forward. And so this is actually a really good way to document, you know, who are the undocumented people in the state of Oregon, because we don't even know who those people are, right? So in some way, you know, because Washington, D.C. and Capitol Hill can't figure out a solution, this is why states have been doing this all across the country.
Well, that was my next question, was what documents are needed? And
so proof of identification, right? Of course, some sort of electric bill, like whatever sort of utility bill that can prove that you actually live in this area. But more than that, I mean, I think this is where all politics is local, right? I mean, you guys know that we go to the same church as you do. We go to the same school as you do. We shop at the same stores as you do. So this is just acknowledging something that we all know exists, which is that we're here.
Right.
And we're in your communities.
Absolutely.
And I think the opponents of this measure, you know, Oregonians for Immigration Reform, which is actually a very inaccurate title, they're for deporting people. So, you know, they'd rather pretend that we're not here. But we are.
Right.
There's 160,000 undocumented people in the state of Oregon, collectively paying, what, $95 million in state and local taxes in 2010 alone, including property taxes, because we actually own property,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But these are the facts that most people, I don't think, realize.
Absolutely. And that leads me to my next question. You were talking about this is one way to document people.
Yeah.
If just in these hypothetical scenarios, if somebody has this alternate driver's license, and has to deal with police either in an accident or getting pulled over,
yeah.
Is there a fear that, you know, with this card, it's kind of like being marked?
Oh, of course. And that's, you know, I mean, that's been kind of part of the tension in all these other states that have passed these laws. But if you're undocumented in this country, you take what you can get. Right. This is that's the sad reality of it. I mean, I wish that this bill, you know, that this law was even stronger than what this Democratic controlled legislator, what the Democratic governor was able to pass. But at least it's something. It's not perfect, but at least it actually provides a driver's card, which is a very limited. Right. You can't use it to vote.
Mm-hmm.
People seem to think that we vote. Undocumented people can't vote.
Permanent residents can't vote.
Exactly. But that's just, again, another fact that a lot of people don't seem to know. This is not about using government services. This is not about using this to fly. Like, this is a driver's card to be used for driving, right? For the safety of everybody in the state. You know, I mean, I hear the argument being, why would you reward more criminality? I don't think trying to earn a living and provide for your family is a crime. I don't think wanting to drive your kid to school is a crime. I don't think trying to drive to go to church is a crime. Is there anything more American than driving?
Right, right. I guess I'm still a little bit hung up on what happens if, you know, this is a group of people who
been marginalized and been,
who have
living
been marginalized,
in fear their whole lives.
Living in fear and yeah. right and taking these steps to do the right thing.
Yeah.
I'm all on board with all this. I'm more worried if there is a situation involving a police force with this card that marks you. And that it doesn't mean I'm against this regulation. I'm just saying what happens
oh,
next.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but that's, but that, by the way, that's why in the state of California, California passed a law called the Trust Act, meaning that the cop, you know, the police shouldn't be turning over undocumented people to immigration officials.
They
right?
shouldn't. And how has that been going?
Well, we don't know yet what the numbers are in California, okay. but that's something that would be needed in Oregon as well.
Right.
But one step at a time, one step
steps,
at a time.
Right.
And when you're undocumented, you know, it's like, as I said, you kind of take what you can get at some point. It's either this or, I mean, I just remember when I was, you know, undocumented driving with a driver's, you know, driving with a license like this, even I would, you know, I would clam up and get nervous whenever I saw a cop drop by, you know.
We all do, but yes, it's a much more magnified,
yeah, it's a much
greater
more magnified
issue,
thing
within
when you have this kind of in your head.
Right, right.
Again, like, let's leave immigration aside. This is a public safety issue that is for the good of all Oregonians. I think we can all kind of agree just on the facts. We all feel safer when people know how to drive. And there weren't, and when they're insured, measures like 88 are necessary because our congressional members haven't been able to come up with a solution to actually once and for all, you know, come up with immigration reform. That's why we need something like this, and we can't wait for Congress to finally get its act together because it looks like that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Not in this lifetime. Jose Antonio Vargas, thank you so much for chatting with me and for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jose Antonio Vargas and earlier Rick Steves articulating why we should vote yes on ballot measures 91 and 88. This is KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sari Gametta. Thanks for listening.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:27 a.m. and we have this community announcement. Check it out. Doug Matheson, author of Actually Thinking Versus Just Believing, was interviewed on KBOO in August, and he will be speaking this Sunday, October 26th, at the Humanists of Greater Portland. They meet every Sunday at 10 a.m. in the Friendly House, located at the corner of Northwest Thurman Street and 26th Avenue, in Portland. This programming note, we have a change in the final Radio Zine program today. Coming up, we'll be hearing Making Contact on Thwarting Democracy, the Battle for Voting Rights, right here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. Keep it locked.
I'm Laura Flynn, and this is Making Contact.
We had an ultra-segregationist by the name of Leander Perez, who was a part of the National White Citizen Council for Alabama, Mississippi, and all those states to prevent people from registering to vote. But Mr. Victor Ragus was one of the civil rights leaders, and he started the first march for the right to vote in Black Comparison in 1941. So people be hearing about Selma, Alabama, and all other places in the country. My exhibit here in this building is so that future generations understand that when you think of Dr. Martin Luther King and all these people, you have people in Black Comparison been doing this work, you know, since the early 40s.
Reverend Tyrone Edwards' exhibit, Freedom Fighters for the Right to Vote, honors the struggle for civil rights in Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana. Communities throughout the South, just like this one, are filled with local heroes who never made it to the history books, but played an influential role in shaping civil rights legislation. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll hear how people are trying to preserve these legacies and how 50 years after the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, shifting policies are threatening some of those hard-fought gains towards equality. First, we head to Monroe, Georgia, where the last mass lynching in the U.S. took place back in 1946. The case remains open, but one group stages an annual reenactment in hopes of solving it and drawing attention to the political repression at the time. Anna Simonton's father plays a Klansman in the reenactment. She takes us to the scene.
They say you've been putting your hands on my woman. The hell you got to say about that, Hester? I ain't gonna tell you again. Get off my property before I kick you off.
It was in 1946 in the small town of Monroe, Georgia, on a hot July afternoon, when Roger Malcolm, a black man, accused his white employer, Barnett Hester, of sleeping with his wife. Their argument turned physical, and Malcolm stabbed Hester, then fled. He turned himself over to local law enforcement later that day and was booked at the Walton County Jail. Roger Malcolm's wife, Dorothy Malcolm, sought help from Loy Harrison, a wealthy white farmer her relatives worked for. On July 25, 1946, Harrison drove Dorothy Malcolm, along with her brother and his wife, to Monroe, where they bailed out Roger Malcolm from jail.
Mr. Loy, I so appreciate this.
Yeah, we better go.
On the way to the farm, Harrison took a back road through cotton fields and groves of trees. When they arrived at the Moores Ford Bridge, vehicles blocked the road on the other side. Men emerged from them and advanced toward Harrison's car as he slowed down. They had laid in wait for Roger Malcolm, the black man who had stabbed his white boss.
What's going on?
We want that Roger!
Some of the men pulled Roger Malcolm from the car and put a noose around his neck. They began to lead him down to a field when Dorothy Malcolm suddenly shouted the name of one of the members of the mob. Later, Loy Harrison would tell the FBI that this happened, but would insist he couldn't remember the name she shouted.
You know him?
Instead of lynching only Roger Malcolm, they would execute the three witnesses as well. It would be the last mass lynching in the United States.
Get them all!